This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Okay, Catherine, so we don't normally do this, but we are going to give a shout out to the mostly delightful feedback and reviews that we get from our beautiful listeners. Catherine, we were sending emails the other day and you were a little bit annoyed because someone has given us a 2-star review on iTunes and it's messed with our 5-star rating.
Well, I hadn't even looked on iTunes. I think I was looking up a different podcast to find out more about it. And then having looked at that podcast, it recommended to me our podcast.
Nice.
So then I went and had a look and the ratings come up. And someone had given a 2-star rating. But I was in a space at work where I began to stew. And then I started emailing you like, why have they given us a 2-star rating?
I love
and
it when you begin to
And then followed it up with like another email of,
you did.
Why do I care?
Why do
like,
I care?
Should I be talking? Which like about 4 emails I sent. That, no, you
really
didn't reply
great.
To any.
No, because I was like, I'm just going to let you have your own little stew here and I'm not going to buy into this stewing. But there's not many 2-star. Well, there's only one. Everything else is delightful. We got a lovely one. Tell about the one on Twitter.
Oh, that was lovely. So that was Emily Paul with 2 L's on Twitter. And she said that catching up with At The First Time Pod over coffee feels like having coffee with friends. Catherine and Kate, she's used our Twitter handles. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. It's definitely affected how I'm preparing for the release of my book in December.
Which is completely
so
lovely.
Nice.
And it's the vibe. That
exactly.
is the vibe. We want you to feel like you're sitting down with us having coffee. And we very much look forward to seeing your book, Emily, when it comes out in December 2. I wanted to read some of our 5-star reviews from iTunes listeners, some of our recent ones. Meg Reed said, essential listening. The First Time Podcast is essential listening for all writers. Kate and Catherine generously share their experience as first-time novelists and interview other wonderful writers who bear their writing souls. Yes, we make them do that, Meg. So much to learn for any writer at any stage, which is great feedback. And there was another one I really liked from Pracky. So good. I listen to a lot of writing podcasts. This is by far my favorite. The guest writers share thoughtful pieces of advice and their personal publishing stories drawn out by the warm hosts. Warm. I like that we're warm. And I appreciate every word highly recommended for the writing community. So that gives us all the warm, buzzy feelings.
That's really nice.
This is what I would have said to you had I been responding to your emails that day, Catherine. And we wanted to let you know that you too can, of course, leave us a review. We don't ask you to a lot, but apparently it does really work wonders for what the algorithms on iTunes, etc.
Secret algorithms.
It's secret algorithms. So please do, if you are so inclined, leave us a rating wherever you listen. We don't only get feedback like that though, Catherine.
No, we also get emails. And we had an email this week, I won't name the sender of the email, but it was about the editing process. Very interesting email about what... We talk about the editing process, we talk about the different stages, the structural, the copy, the proof, but what does it actually involve? And it's sort of an understandable question.
It is,
totally. Because it is a bit of a mysterious process.
It is.
So we'll try and be really, really, really specific in answering this question. Kate, you went through an editing process with Skylarking.
Yeah.
You're about to do it again.
Yeah.
In minor, tiny little steps of detail.
Yeah.
What did it involve?
So my structural edit involved lots, like 3 pages of notes maybe in like a letter form from my editor. Big picture things like under headings. So they might be under the headings like character, you know, or Kate, that particular character, or they might be under the heading love triangle or something like that. And so you've got these big picture responses that you then respond to. And I think that that's basically the idea of a structural edit. The idea is that the editor or the reader is saying to you, here's what I see about the piece as a whole. And I've had this in manuscript assessments and beta reads as well.
Yeah.
Here's what I think of the manuscript as a whole. Here are some of my flag points or the things that aren't working.
Yeah.
And then the idea is that you as a writer go away and you stew over those and you come up with some solutions.
That's right.
To those kinds of questions. Is that how you feel like your structural went?
I think the thing about structural edit that maybe people don't mightn't realise is that there's nothing written on the manuscript.
Yeah.
Like there's no markup. There's no this bit doesn't make sense. Like it's none of
yours
that.
Yours was a conversation kind of,
mine
wasn't
was
it?
A conversation. Yeah. Yeah. And so it is so much more. I think the structural edit is 95% of the work.
Yeah.
It is all that big picture stuff. What that looks like, I think, is it's like if you watch a movie or something and then at the end of the movie you sort of turn to someone and go, but why wouldn't they call the cops?
Yes.
Or like, I don't get why they would even like that person.
Yeah.
Like it's that level of stuff.
At the structural edit you can lose characters.
Yes.
Chapters, to give a what it looks like for the current book that I'm working on, and this isn't really even at structural edit stage, but some of the feedback, particularly from international people who are reading internationally, was, you know, oh, we need a little bit more context here. Now, I had just cut like the first 10,000 words from my manuscript, so what I'd inadvertently done is cut out some of the context, if that makes sense. So I put back in some of the world-building kinds of ideas. So it can be 20,000 words cut, 30,000 words cut. You added 30,000 words.
Towards the end, so I did a structural edit to start off with, and I think what I did with that, which I wouldn't do again, is I went to the start and I, so if I needed something, so I needed, say, a certain character relationship to be deepened, that I went to the start and I just sort of wrote new scenes or I changed whole aspects in a really dramatic way. Whereas when I did a later edit, which was just out of sequence, but I would have called the later edit far more structural, and in approaching editing for my current work, I would never do it that way again. Yeah. You have to cut in.
I think this is why it's so hard to talk about and the mystery of it, because obviously it's extraordinarily different for every person. And also that fear that if you go into a structural edit and you think, oh, structural edit is about cutting 20,000 words or dropping characters, then suddenly you're looking to do that. And maybe your manuscript doesn't need that.
Whereas I think for me, in general, like when I say cut in, it's about going to, so if there was Jermaine in the helpline and Jack, going to every scene with Jermaine and Jack and building. Yep. So, you know, maybe it was adding a new scene in two spots, but in fact, it was every scene that the two of them were in, adding a bit here, adding a bit there so that they had a relationship that was much deeper.
Yeah.
It wasn't about starting at the start. No. And
on a practical level,
through.
I'm always so in awe of this. You're so good with spreadsheets that you have that kind of color coordinated and you can jump in.
Yeah, that makes it a lot easier.
For someone like me, I cut an entire character from the book recently, and what I have to do is search for the words.
Keep finding
them. To literally make sure I've picked them all up. I mean, I know where this character is, but that's how I get through it on a very practical kind of a level.
Yeah.
I think too what we'll do is maybe in the show notes, I will certainly put up a picture of my copy edit of Skylarking, because I take this round to schools a lot. It's very tattered right now because I've had it out a lot of days recently. But it's got 30 to 40
marks.
Pencil marks on each page.
Yeah.
And this is, and I tell this to kids all the time, this is like draft 17 or something, but it has that many marks and they're small, like they're tiny marks, most of them.
The difference is, so you, the copy edit as opposed to the structural edit, so the copy edit, you will get the marked up and most, you would be lucky to have a page that would not have something on it. That is actually very quick to digest though, isn't it? Like that is sitting there going comma, full stop, change, switch around. Like
entirely different headspace.
That's not a challenging.
No. The structural edit is that,
that's,
you know, you've
work.
Seen me in that stage before and I'm like, I wish I had an engineering brain. Like it's like logistics and problem solving. It's so hard to do.
It's so hard to hold in your head too, is such a challenging, you know, to be able to see it.
I don't know if that fully answers your question, dear listener, but I also recommend If you haven't gone back through, and for new listeners, check out the episode with Mandy Brett, which I think is such a good one on
it's
editing.
Great.
Also, Mark Randy, in our interview with him, talks about consistency and things like that in terms of why we love editors so much. And yeah, that may be helpful for you as well.
I'm thrilled to be speaking with debut author Janali Jones in Melbourne for the Black and Bright Festival. Janali Jones is a woman of the Gunai Nation. She completed a Master of Arts in Creative Writing at UTS. She was recently shortlisted for the Text Prize for YA, and her debut YA novel, My Father's Shadow, published by Magabala Books, won the Black and Bright Indigenous Writing Fellowship.
Welcome, Janali.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming in at quite short notice to do this. I was so thrilled. And I just told you, I just finished reading your book in one enormous hit yesterday, and it's fabulous. So I can't wait to talk about that too. For starters, how has the Black and Bright Festival been for you so far?
It's been really great. I've been able to, you know, meet a lot of writers who I haven't met before, but also catch up with old friends. And it's a great festival. I think that Jane Harrison, the artistic director, has done a wonderful job.
Fantastic. Have you done festival appearances before?
No, this is my first one.
So how were you feeling before it all, before you got down here?
I guess I've been pretty busy recently, so it hasn't really sunk in. But when I was on the plane heading here, it was kind of like, oh, this is really cool, you know, this opportunity that I have. And, you know, I worked so hard on the book and getting it to, you know, publication standard that it's really good to be able to participate in these kinds of events and meet people and get feedback. And yeah, it's really a fantastic opportunity.
So I know that you are also a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Does public speaking frighten you? Not frighten you?
So actually, I don't think it has much to do with me being a lawyer, because I've always been a sort of corporate lawyer. So
okay.
not
you don't
in
have to do
litigation
any.
Courts yep. that I have no experience at that side.
Okay.
Of but I was a teacher for a couple of years at Tranby Aboriginal College, which
okay.
is based in Glebe, Sydney. And I think that's where I really, you know, ironed out any public speaking anxieties I had left over. But, you know, I've played music for a long time, performed, so I've done that since I was a kid. So I've never really been one who hated public speaking. It's something that I'm not too worried about.
That shall serve you so well. let's go back to a beginning of sorts. Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Absolutely. It's one of the things that as a kid, you know, you go through all these different jobs that you want to be. Like, I think I wanted to be a policewoman at one point. What was I thinking? I went through an astronaut phase, which
nice.
A lot of kids do. But I've always wanted to write stories, and I grew up around books, had a very, you know, heavy, you know, family that was very into reading. And
yep.
whenever I saw my grandma, the first question would always be, so tell me, Nali, what are you reading?
And what were you reading at that time? What are the earliest kind of favourite books that you can remember?
Very early on in primary school age, it was Goosebumps was just all the
huge.
Rage.
Yeah. Yep.
So I was definitely into horror. And then sci-fi was big for me when I was in primary school as well. I read a lot of Ken Catron, a New Zealand writer, and
okay.
Some other books like that. And that was what I was reading.
So can you remember the very first thing you ever had published? Was there something that was published at school? Or
I think I wrote a poem. I can't remember the exact name of the anthology, but it was for young writers.
Yeah.
And it was an environmental type poem that my grandpa actually helped me to write, which I could probably still recite if I thought hard enough.
Oh my goodness, what was it called?
Good question. I can't remember the title. But yeah, so, and it was the kind of thing where you sent off and it was accepted, and then you had to buy the anthology to get a copy, which is quite unusual. Usually
yeah.
if you're in something, they give you a free copy. So my mom thought it was a bit of a scam, and she never bought me a copy. So
you never
sad.
Got to see it?
No, I didn't.
Wow.
So there you go. It's some mysterious first poem out there.
But you got a taste for publication, or that idea of being successful as a writer.
Yeah, definitely. I can't remember how old I was, but I would have been primary school age. And yeah, that was very thrilling to be able to do that. Yeah.
And were you, you know, journaling, writing a novel when you were in high school? Like, what was your kind of writing practice as you carried on through school then?
Yeah, I definitely wrote, I was writing a fantasy saga in high school.
Yep.
Which kind of was a form of escapism for me as well. You know, like a lot of people, I was someone who was bullied a lot in high school. So that was kind of a way for me to like check out and go into my own fantasy world. And it's this, you know, several book legs, like I haven't written it all, but I had planned, you know, this wow. epic saga of these sort of tall ships and kind of Game of Thrones-esque. I don't know. I'd like to actually go back and write it properly.
I was going to say, it sounds like a pretty complicated, like well-built world if yeah. you had that much mapped out.
I think I actually have the skills to write it properly now. So, yeah, might throw out the old notes from when I was 15 years old and just start again. Yeah.
So did you ever think about writing as a career straight up when you left school, or was it just said, no, you can't write, or you had other interests at that stage?
I think that I was really confused, and I think that's very normal.
Yeah.
When you leave high school, you don't really know what you want to do. You know, I often wish that I had taken a gap year. Mm. Not that that probably would have helped anyway. So, you know, I got good, you know, relatively good marks for my HSC. So I applied to law. That was my first choice. But then, you know, I was also thinking about going to ADFA.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
My dad was in the army, you know, I applied to the CON, like Conservatorium of Music yep. in Sydney. Like I was like all over
you
the
had
shop.
A lot of so I think strings that, to your bow.
Yeah, I think that communications at UTS was maybe number 5 on the list.
Yeah, okay.
I just didn't know what to do. So yeah, but you know, I always had in the back of my mind that, you know, because it had been a hobby of mine for so long that eventually I wanted to get published.
And what eventually took you back, because you went back to do your Masters of Creative Writing?
Mm-hmm.
What prompted that? What took you back?
Oh, so I guess about second year of law school, I realized I don't want to be a lawyer. What am I doing? But I was like, oh, I'm halfway through. I may as well finish the degree.
Yeah.
And as you know, I'm still a lawyer today. Yeah, so that worked out well.
Yeah.
So I finished the law degree and then I went and I started doing arts at Sydney Uni. And again, not really sure, you know, what I was doing. Ran out of money and then got a job at NITV as a okay. paralegal. So then I was sort of introduced to the world of having like regular income.
Yep.
And so that kind of made me give up the arts degree and go back to working. But again, I was just reminded, oh, law's not really what I want to do. So after about a year, and during that year, I also was trying to get into the conservatorium with flute. And
wow.
Yeah, it's very
lots
complicated.
Of talent.
So with the flute, I did get into a couple of schools. I got into UNSW Music and I got into another small college. But I had this thing in my head that, you know, if I can't get into the best school and I can't get into the performance stream for flute, then I may as well not try. So the conservatorium offered me music teaching, and I did do a semester of composition.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, you know, flute, I'm, you know, somewhat good at flute, but it's not a natural talent for me. Whereas I felt like writing, I had a little bit of natural talent. So I would argue
quite a lot of natural talent.
I don't want to, you know, be too big about myself, but, yeah, so I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to go back to my original love of writing. And so that's why I went back and did a master's at UTS in creative writing, because I thought I really wanted to make sure that I had the skills and the knowledge of structure and that sort of thing to make the most of a career.
And so you weren't right, from what I understand, from what I've read about you, you weren't writing My Father's Shadow at that point.
No.
Where did the seed for My Father's Shadow come from?
It just came from this image that I had of this girl, Kaya, the protagonist, sitting in the car with her mum while she's like driving crazily along this mountain road, and she's crying and really upset and being a passenger in this really like horrifying situation where you feel like she's going to like drive yes. up the side of the mountain.
It's a really early scene.
Yeah.
Did you write it straight out like that and has it stayed the same?
Well, I mean, I sort of often get images or ideas sort of come to me or I get inspired. I'll just write them down in a list. So I always have like a list of different kind of seeds.
Okay, our listeners really like the nitty-gritty details. So do you have a writing notebook? Do you have a list on your phone? Do you have an open document on your laptop? How do you keep your writing ideas together?
So at the moment it's a list on my phone that I have of writing ideas. So that was just one of them that I had, and I'd heard about Black and Right, the Black and Right Indigenous Writing Fellowship since it began, I think it was about 2011. Always wanted to enter it. The manuscript that I'd been working on at the time, I thought, yeah, it's good, but not up to probably what they're looking for. I don't know what I was basing that on, but so I decided to take that idea that I'd had because I thought that was interesting and had the potential to be perhaps a bit more literary, because the other thing I was working on was fantasy.
Okay.
I thought they might like the literary idea a bit more. Not that I would describe My Father's Shadow as particularly literary. and so I just wrote from that and tried to figure out like who these characters were and why they were upset and where they were going, and the story grew from there.
It's a absolute page-turner, marketed as YA, and Kaya is...
17.
Yeah. It's a thrilling kind of keeps you on the edge of your seat right up until the last page. Was it the first time you said you've been writing fantasy, sci-fi? Was this the first time you'd written like a crime thriller?
Yes. I had made some early attempts at doing crime sort of noir fiction.
Yeah.
But never seriously. That was more something I just did for fun on the side, but this is the first full work that I've done that is like thriller, that is, you know, modern realism rather than like fantasy or futuristic sci-fi or dystopian or anything like that. So yeah, it is a bit of a departure for me, but at the same time I think it's probably good as a debut novel.
It's a perfect debut novel. It's a perfect debut novel too, and also to break into that to the YA market and hit that straight away. Mm. I think it's terrific. I think that it will go very far. The novel follows Kaya, this young woman, as you've said, who's experiencing PTSD, and she's going through therapy to recover some repressed memories that are significant and important to a trial that's coming up. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience of writing that PTSD and research that you might have had to do for that?
So for the PTSD side of it, I definitely had to do research. I realised in adulthood that I was actually suffering from a mild form of trauma because of some events that happened in my early childhood. And it took me a while to realise that that's what it was. Basically, I was having these illogical reactions to certain situations. So I actually went to cognitive behaviour therapy to try and deal with, the events that had happened to me and sort of work through my reactions in the modern day now. Yeah. So that was an interesting process. And I'm still dealing with it to an extent now, but because I've gone through that process, I'm a lot better.
Yeah.
And so I had some experience
sure.
to draw on, and some of the scenes sort of reflect some reactions that I've had to trauma. But PTSD is like another level.
Yeah.
So I definitely felt that I needed to do some research in order to reflect that properly. And the whole idea of her having PTSD really came from the fact that she has, you know, been involved with this whistleblowing, you know, with these criminals. And, you know, when I first wrote some of the early drafts, she didn't really have that kind of a reaction to it. And I just thought, well, something really big has happened to her. Surely there would be some kind of response. So I thought that by putting in the PTSD, it would make it more realistic, particularly seeing it's not just the fact that these events have happened, but her father has then also passed away. So I thought that gave it a bit more authenticity.
You show the character of Kaya so well. She feels very alive to me. It's also a terrific narrative device, the way that those memories come back, the way that you are able to flip between flashbacks and the present story as well. How did you keep track of the structure of it? Did a lot of that happen in editing, or was it there that way from the start?
I had to work on where the scenes were appearing in terms of the flashbacks. And it was actually till quite late that I was, you know, pulling scenes out and moving them around to find out where they best fit with the you know, contemporary time, you know, the narrative of the main narrative of the book. So it was a process of, you know, experimenting with, you know, where the scenes would fit best, where they made sense in terms of where she was at in terms of her time in the Blue Mountains, and also her journey into finding more out about what was happening and the clues that she was picking up along the way.
Was that part of when you applied for the Black and Right Fellowship? Mm-hmm. You just had done one draft, a couple of drafts. What was that kind of length of time?
So I'd probably written maybe a page or page and a half or something. I used to be a part of a writer's group with some of my friends and workshopped, you know, a page or two. And that was just that scene in the car, really.
Yeah.
I really wrote the full draft for NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month.
I did the most of my debut novel during NaNoWriMo, actually. It's the way to get us going.
Yeah, definitely. I've done it a few times, and, you know, it helps, you know. Maybe not the best quality writing, but, you know, it gets words on the page.
Absolutely.
So did that in November 2014, and then over summer I worked on just polishing it a little bit, editing it, and submitted it early in 2015.
When did you find out about being successful with the Black and Right Fellowship?
I can't remember exactly when it was. It was definitely in 2015. It was when I was teaching, and I got a phone call from them. And I was in my car about to head home from work. And, yeah, they told me that I'd been selected. And it was amazing. I started crying.
I love that.
It was crazy. It was so good to get recognition at that early stage that, you know, someone had seen my work and thought I had potential. But, you know, that it was good. So
I think that validation, we interviewed in our first season, we interviewed Claire G. Coleman, who is also a recipient of the Black and Right Fellowship.
Yeah.
And I remember her saying just that initial confidence and validation, exactly as you're saying.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, you've got, is it a lot like a mentorship program? How did it work for you?
Yeah, so at the time I did it, there was a prize money and 12 months of editing, working with the Black and Right team through State Library of Queensland.
Yep.
And then after the 12 months, then you work with the publisher. So at the time it was Mungabala.
Okay.
I think it's Hachette now.
That's
it's
right.
Black and Right. So yeah, then I went on and did editing with the Mungabala team.
And so what was that process like? Had you been edited before? I know that you've been published in other literary journals, etc. Had you been edited much before?
I mean, when I did the creative writing masters, there's a lot of workshopping.
Yeah.
Where you send around your work to everyone, like on your chosen week, and then everyone in class gives you feedback.
Yes.
So it's really great because it breaks you in. But I remember one of the first classes, I was so insulted. I was so upset. You guys don't know anything. You don't get it. But it was a good like learning curve for me, because instead of being like, oh, you're an idiot, you don't understand, maybe I'm doing something because I'm not communicating my meaning well enough.
Yes.
You know, so it made me realize that, you know, criticism isn't there to hurt you. It's usually about trying to make it better. So I think through going through that process through studying, I was already used to getting, you know, feedback, edits, that sort of thing. And I also did a graduate certificate in editing and publishing.
Ah, so you were a pro.
Well, I worked with Nicola O'Shea in one of the classes. She was brilliant, and she is a professional editor, freelance editor. And she really walked us through like what a structural edit is, like copy editing, everything. So I felt like I was really prepared for when it came to Mangabala and giving me like official, you know, notes on my work. So for me, it wasn't surprising. And I think that I was able to respond well to the feedback. And, you know, because I think for new writers, maybe it can be a bit jarring, and yes, maybe it can feel like you're, you know, getting your heart ripped out.
Yes. But
thankfully for me, I didn't have that experience because I felt like I was prepared and I knew more or less happening. What was going to happen. Yeah.
What kinds of substantial changes happened over those kind of two working years while you were working on it?
So the first draft that went to black and white had a lot of themes and content in it that wasn't appropriate for YA.
Okay.
So Mangabala told me, you need to take this stuff out.
Yeah, right. And had you written it as YA, intending it to be YA, or was that kind of a marketing discussion as you worked with Black and White and Mangabala?
I don't think that I wrote it with YA in mind, but I've had a few people tell me in other work as well that I have a YA style.
Yep.
And I know that a lot of the characters in other things that I've written just are teenagers.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a hallmark of YA fiction is
teenagers.
So I think it was more Mangabala making me realise this is YA rather than me doing it intentionally.
Sure. How did you feel about cutting a whole lot of your content?
I didn't mind, and I, which again, it sounds like I'm actually not lying because it might sound like I am, but because I wrote it for the competition.
Yes.
And I'm so excited about being, you know, having potentially being published because, you know, I was never like, yep, I'm getting published. I was like, no, I have to still work hard to get it published. I, you know, I put faith in Mangabala that they knew what they were talking about.
Yep.
You know, they're in the market. They know what sells. They know what, you know, YA readers like to read. And, you know, a lot of the themes that were in that book, I realize now that, you know, those are the kind of things that are sort of differentiate between YA and adult fiction. So, yeah, I really just trusted in them and trusted in the process. And I think that it's such a better book now anyway that I've done that. And even though they, you know, were quite, you know, strong about, you know, you need to take this section out, they still gave me a lot of freedom in terms of recrafting it. So they weren't sort of like, you know, turn this person into X person. It wasn't that specific.
Sure.
They still trusted me as a writer to be able to make those edits.
That's a sign of such a great editor, I think, when someone kind of opens up a question, I suppose, for you or poses something to you that allows you then to make the book or the chapter or the sentence or the character more towards the intention of what you had at the beginning, I suppose.
Yeah, and it also for me goes back to the thing about criticism is usually not about, you know, tearing apart the work or making you feel bad. It's actually about trying to make the work better.
I really liked a guest post you did for Booktopia, and we'll link to that in our show notes. And you said, I wanted to write a book that was subtle in the way it explored cultural identity. Can you tell us a bit about how you did this in My Father's Shadow?
Yeah, so Kaya is somewhat disconnected from her culture due to a family rift. And you can see a few points throughout the book, but she's really, you know, she regrets that. And her nan, who was the center of the community that her nan lived in and had this, you know, there was so much richness in the way that she lived and the things that she did, you know, she took in people and shared her home and her kitchen and used to paint and do all these wonderful things. And Kaya really misses that. And because of the family rift that's happened, she kind of doesn't get to experience that anymore. And, you know, a lot of Indigenous people that I've met, but not for the same reasons, but a lot of us do have that, you know, disconnection in some ways, whether it be geographical or through other reasons. So I kind of wanted to talk about culture in a way that was looking at different experiences of culture, mm-hmm. and how we can still feel very connected to land and identity without necessarily being, you know, stereotypes. Mm. And I think it's important to have that in literature because when I was growing up, I often felt confused about what it was to be an Aboriginal person because I didn't grow up with that side of my family. So I think the more representations that we have out there, the better, because it's great to see yourself reflected. And I didn't really get that until I read Terry Jenke's Butterfly Song.
Okay.
And one of the character in there talks about, you know, she's asked about a book about an Aboriginal girl, and she just says something like, "Oh, you know, I didn't know about that. That wasn't me. You know, I'm Aboriginal, yes, but you know, I'm not. You know, it wasn't like I'm not a walking encyclopedia."
Yeah.
And that kind of felt like it gave me permission to feel okay that, you know, I didn't know all answers to all of the questions that people always ask me about being Aboriginal.
Yeah. Has that been part of the publicity? Have you felt that pressure to be representative and talk about exactly what you're saying there? Like, yes, this is this particular experience as an Aboriginal writer as opposed to a young writer or a female writer. How have you felt you've had to perform any of those identities, I suppose?
I don't feel that it's I've had pressure in any way because people usually ask me as it relates to the book.
Yeah.
And I, you know, these days I do feel confident in myself and who I am. So, yeah. You know, if people ask me something that makes me feel uncomfortable or that I don't know about, I'm very happy to say, "Oh no, I don't know anything about that."
Yeah.
And yeah. So, most of the questions have been around representation and things that I, you know, feel I can talk about. So
when the book, when you first got to see the book, what was that moment like?
I received a few copies from Magabala in advance, the author copies, and they arrived in a big brick. And I pulled them out and I was in the post office, and it was strange. It was weird. I don't think it had quite sunk in, but it was incredible because seeing the cover, which is something that I didn't have any input into.
Yeah.
They did, Magabala asked me, they were like, "Do you have any ideas or a vision?" And I was like, "No, I trust you. You guys are the professionals." And when I saw the cover, I couldn't have designed it better. It's just perfect to me. And Janali, my name, it means moon. And there's a moon on the cover. So, you know, I think it's wonderful.
It's a gorgeous cover.
So that, yeah, I was just really happy with how it turned out.
And then how have you found, I know you've done some media, you've got blog posts, places, you've now got the festival. How are you finding that aspect of being an author out on the road talking about my book? You know, what's that been like for you?
Yeah, it's been really good. I love talking to people who have read the book because, so far the feedback that I've received is really positive, most of it.
Yeah.
I did receive criticism from a friend of a friend, but that's okay. Nothing too bad. It was just about...
Not by a good reason, right?
It was about burner phones, so...
Oh.
But he hadn't read the whole thing, so...
Okay.
You know. But, you know, it's been fun, and I know that it doesn't sort of last forever, so I've kind of tried to be enjoying the interviews and really thankful for everyone who does, you know, take the time to read the book and have me on their shows.
I want to ask you about your kind of writing process, whether you are a person who has a daily writing goal, whether you are a binge writer who needs to go away and write. You said that you've done NaNoWriMo a couple of times. Mm. How do you fit writing around your full-time job that you have?
I am not someone who, my husband would disagree with me, but I don't think I'm a very disciplined person.
Okay.
So I, you know, I'd love to say, oh, I wake up at 5 and write for 3 hours in the morning, but I'm not able to do that. I, you know, often if I'm, you know, up early enough, maybe I'll go into work an hour early and write before work or write on my lunch break. Usually afternoons after work are just, I'm too exhausted to, to do anything.
Yes.
So it is, you know, finding the time because, you know, I think I'm lucky that when I actually do sit down with no distractions and have a blank page in front of me, I'm actually able to do quite a lot of work, which is good, but then depressing in other ways because I think, oh, I could have been doing this the whole time. But so I think, yeah, it's just about taking moments where I can and actually forcing myself to sit down and write because these days there's so many distractions, you know, it's podcasts and streaming and audio books and traditional books and so
much content to get through. Do you have a writing community, Janali?
I have a number of friends who, you know, were part of the writers group that I used to be a part of, and I have a close friend, Jordan, who I often bounce ideas off, and we work on some collaborations sometimes. So it's really valuable to have writer friends because in the past I've given my writing to people like my husband or my mum who read things and then they're like, this was great. I'm like,
yes.
Okay, but how can I improve it? You know, it's wonderful that they like it, but writer friends can really, you know, get into the nitty gritty.
Yes.
And, you know, suggestions on what to change.
Sometimes I give, if I'm expecting some criticism from a reader, I'll send it to my mum at the same time so that I know that she'll come back and say, it's wonderful, and then I'll get the criticism at the same time. Janali, you've recently been shortlisted for the Text YA Prize as well, and that's for another entirely different project.
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about that? Is it something we should be expecting to see on shelves at some point soon?
I wish I had some wonderful publication news, but not yet.
Okay.
So this one's called Yenda, and I wrote it a long time ago. I wrote it in NaNoWriMo 2009.
Fantastic. I feel like this is a good advertisement for everyone to getting primed for NaNoWriMo.
Yeah, it's coming up.
It is coming up.
So definitely, you know, even if you don't finish, it's still good to attempt it.
Watching that little graph go up.
Yeah, it's very
addictive and rewarding.
Mine are usually like a small hill and then you know, a big jump right in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
So so I wrote it about 10 years ago and kind of been working on and off on it. I have been watching text for a while, and I actually did a residence, it was a young writer in residence with the Catherine Susanna Pritchard Writer Centre.
Oh, fantastic.
That was about 8 years ago or something now. And I met Stephen Daisley there, who'd just been published, had an award-winning book with text. And he was like, oh, you should send this to text, because he was sort of a mentor that I got as part of the residency.
Yep.
And he was very positive about it. So I kind of always had that in the back of my mind that, oh, maybe I should send it to text.
Yes.
So, sent it to text and was shortlisted, which was wonderful. They had a ceremony here in Melbourne earlier in the year, and I got to meet a lot of them. And, they gave me some feedback on it as well. So that's sort of the one that I'm focusing on next. And it's also young adult, but it's a fantasy set in a remote Northern Territory community.
Wow. I want to read that. Can you please hurry up and finish writing it? If it's anywhere near as page-turning and well done as My Father's Shadow, I want to get my hands on it. Anything else in the works?
I did write another book for... I was doing a research degree through UWS, sort of a creative research degree, and I wrote a manuscript which was... sort of crime fiction fantasy. So kind of a blend of these.
I love these two. This kind of genre hopping and bending.
Yeah, so that's sort of on the back burner as well. I'll probably get to that after Yenda. And that's sort of loosely based on some murders in a small New South Wales town.
Okay.
But also incorporates Aboriginal mythology, and that's the fantasy side of it.
Oh my gosh, so many exciting things coming up ahead for you. I want to ask, given your recent experience, what kind of advice you would give to new writers, emerging writers, or writers who are just kind of getting published for the first time?
I think that it's important to really look at your work and try and make it the best that it can be, and to just be persistent when you send things around. You know, it's the old thing, oh, you know, Harry Potter went to 12 publishers.
Yeah.
It's so true, though, because when I was in my sort of short story poetry phase where I was submitting to a lot of literary magazines, I'd always submit about, you know, maybe 4 or 5 things, and I'd get maybe 1 or 2
sure
successes. And so for me, that was like expected that there would be a certain failure rate. And I think that's very normal. So it's just about, you know, if this is something that you really want to do, to just be persistent and, yeah, and just try and make it the best that you can.
Excellent. Janali, thank you so much for speaking with us and for your advice, and so much good luck for these new projects ahead.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Janali Jones, our first time quick five, you are allowed to pass on any questions.
Okay.
For your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Unagented. I don't know how to get an agent. I've tried.
Agents who are out there?
I'm open.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand?
I think I agreed to worldwide, but at the moment it's Australia, although I think you can technically order online from overseas.
Great. Excellent. And festival invites or no festival invites?
Festival invites. Oh, that I've received.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
You have black and bright so far. And Janali, can you give us a debut recommendation, a book of any time, genre, but as a debut?
One of the books that I've read multiple times, particularly when I was a teenager, is Isabel Carmody's Ober Newton.
Yes.
She's an Australian young adult writer, and yeah, I must have read it about 5 times. It's really brilliant, and you know, she started writing it when she was a teenager, which is incredible. So that would be my recommendation.
Double inspo for us.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.